white and alarmed. She grabbed his shirt again and pulled it. "What are we doing?" she asked. "This isn't art appreciation class, for Christ's sake. We've got to get out of here." "Yeah, we do," Steve thought. "The question is, where do we go?" They'd worry about it when they got to the truck, not in here. He had an idea it would be impossible to do any productive thinking in here. "Hey, what happened to the radio?" she asked. "Huh?" He listened, but the music was gone. "I don't know." With a strange, set expression on her face, Cynthia reached out to the crumbling fragment on the table again. This time she touched it between the ears. She gasped. The hanging lights flickered. Steve saw them flicker, and the radio came back on. "Hey, Dwight. Hey, Lyle. Boys, you don't need to fight," Mary Chapin Carpenter sang through the static. "Hot dog, I feel lucky tonight." "Christ," Steve said. "Why'd you do that?" Cynthia looked at Steve. Her eyes looked oddly hazy. She shrugged, touched her tongue to the middle of her upper lip. "I don't know." Suddenly she put her hand to her forehead and squeezed her temples hard. When she took it away, her eyes were clear again, but frightened. "What the hell?" she said, more to herself than to him. Steve reached out to touch the thing himself. She grabbed his wrist before he could. "Don't. It feels nasty." He shook her off and put his finger on the wolf's back. All at once he was sure that was what it was, not a coyote, but a wolf. The radio went dead again. At the same time, there was a cough of broken glass from somewhere behind them. Cynthia yelped. Steve had already taken his finger off the rock. He would have done that even if nothing at all had happened, because she was right. It felt nasty. But for a moment, something did happen. It felt as if one of the more vital circuits in his head had shorted out, for one thing. Except, hadn't he been thinking about the girl? Doing something to the girl? With the girl? The kind of thing both of you might try but would never talk about to your friends? A kind of experiment? Even as he was mulling this over, trying to remember what the experiment might have been, he was reaching out for the stone again with his finger. He didn't make a conscious decision to do this, but now that he was, it seemed like a good idea. "Just let that old finger go where it wants," he thought, bemused. "Let it touch whatever it..." She grabbed his hand and twisted it away from the piece of stone just as he was about to put his finger on the wolf's back. "Hey, sport, read my lips. I want to get out of here, right now." He took a deep breath, let it out, repeated the process. His head began to feel like familiar territory again, but he was suddenly more frightened than ever. Of exactly what, he didn't know. Wasn't sure he wanted to know. "Okay, let's go." Holding her hand, he led her back into the hallway. He glanced over his shoulder once at the crumbled gray bit of carving. Twisted, predatory head. Bulging eyes. Too long snout. Snake tongue. And beyond it, something else. Both the helix and the exhibitionist Goofy were gone. Those screens were dark, as if some power surge had shorted them out. Water was pouring through the open door of the office with the aquarium in it. There was a molly stranded on the edge of the hallway carpet, flopping its last. Well, Steve thought, now we know what broke. No need to wonder about that. "Don't look when we go by," he said. "Just..." "Did you hear something just then?" she asked. "Bangs or booms or something like that?" He listened, heard only the wind, then thought he heard a stealthy shuffling from behind him. He wheeled around quickly. Nothing there. Of course there wasn't. What had he been thinking? That one of the corpses had wriggled down off its hook and was coming after them? Dumb. Even under these stressful circumstances, that was plumb loco, Wild Bill. But there was something else, something he couldn't dismiss, dumb or not. That statue. It was like a physical presence in his head, a thumb poking rudely into the actual tissue of his brain. He wished he hadn't looked at it. Even more, he wished he hadn't touched it. "Steve, did you hear anything? It could have been gunshots. There, there's another one." The wind screamed along the side of the building, and something else fell over out there, making them cry out and grab for each other like kids in the dark. The thing that had fallen over went scraping along the ground outside. "I don't hear anything but the wind. Probably what you heard was a door banging shut somewhere, if you heard anything." "There were at least three of them," she said. "Maybe they weren't gunshots, more like thuds, but..."
"Could have been something flying in the wind, too. Come on, Cookie, let's shake some tail feathers."
"Don't call me Cookie, and I won't call you Cake," she said faintly, not looking when they passed the office with the water still draining out of it. Steve did. The aquarium was now nothing but a rectangle of wet sand surrounded by jags of glass. The hand lay on the soaked carpet beside the desk. It had landed on its back. There was a dead guppy stranded on its palm. The finger seemed almost to beckon him. "Come on in, stranger. Pull up a chair. Take a load off. Mi casa es su casa." "No thanks," Steve thought. He had no more than started to open the door between the literary reception area and the outside when it was snatched prankishly out of his hands. Dust was blowing past in ribbons. The mountains to the west had been completely obliterated by moving membranes of darkening gold, sand and alkali grit flying in the day's last 10 minutes or so of light. But he could see the first stars glowing clearly overhead. The wind was at near gale force now. A rusty old barrel with the words, "Zoom Chemtronics, dispose of properly," stenciled on it, rolled across the parking lot, past the Ryder truck, and across the road. Into the desert it went. The tink, tink, tink of the lanyard clip against the flagpole was feverish now, and something to their left thumped twice, hard, a sound like silencer-muffled pistol shots. Cynthia jerked against him. Steve turned toward the sound and saw a big blue dumpster. As he looked, the wind half-lifted its lid, then dropped it. There was another muffled thump.
"There's your gunshots," he said, raising his voice to be heard over the wind.
"Well, it didn't sound just like that." A concatenation of coyote howls rose in the night, some from the west, flying to them on the wind and grit, some from the north. The sound reminded Steve of old news clips he'd seen of Beatlemania, girls screaming their heads off for the mop tops from Liverpool. He and Cynthia looked at each other.
"Come on," he said. "The truck, right now."
They hurried to it, arms around each other and the wind at their backs. When they were in the cab again, Cynthia locked her door, bopping the button down decisively with the heel of her hand. Steve did the same, then started the engine. Its steady rumble and the glow from the dashboard when he pulled the headlight knob comforted him. He turned to Cynthia.
"All right. Where do we go to report this? Austin's out. It's too far west and in the direction this shit is coming from. We'd end up by the side of the road, hoping we could start the damn engine again once the storm passed. That leaves Ely, which is a 2-hour drive. Longer if the storm overtakes us. Or downtown Desperation, which is maybe less than a mile."
"Ely," she said at once. "The people who did this could be up there in town, and I doubt if a couple of local cops or even county mounties could match up to the guys who could do what we saw in there."
"The people who did it could also be back on Route 50, he said. "Remember the RV and the boss's bike."
"But we did see traffic," she said, then jumped as something else fell over nearby. It sounded big and metallic. "Christ, Steve, can't we please just get the fuck out of here?" He wanted to as badly as she did, but he shook his head.
"Not until we figure this out. It's important. 14 dead people, and that doesn't count the boss or the people from the RV.
The Carver family.
This is going to be big when it comes out. Nationwide. If we go back to Ely and it turns out there were two cops with phones and radios less than a mile up the road, and if the people who did this get away because we took too long blowing the whistle, well, our decision is going to be questioned. Harshly. The dashlights made her face look green and sick. Are you saying they'd think we had something to do with it? I don't know, but I'll tell you this. You're not the Duchess of Windsor and I'm not the Duke of Earl. We're a couple of road bums is what we are. How much ID do you have? A driver's license? I never took the test. Moved around too much. Social Security? Well, I lost the card someplace. I think I left it behind when I split from the guy who fucked up my ear, but I remember the number. What have you got for actual paperwork? My discount card from Tower Records and Video, she snapped. Two punches left and I get a free CD. I'm shooting for Out Come the Wolves. Seems fitting given the soundtrack in these parts. Satisfied? Yeah, he said, and began to laugh. She stared at him for a moment, cheeks green, shadows rippling across her brow, eyes dark, and he felt sure she was going to launch herself at him and see how much of his skin she could pull off. Then she began to laugh too, a helpless, screamy sound he didn't care for much. Come here a second, he said, and held out his hand. Don't you get funny with me, I'm warning you, she said. But she scooted across the seat and into the circle of his arm with no hesitation. He could feel her shoulder trembling against his. She was going to be cold in that tank top if they had to get out of the truck. The temperature fell off the table in this part of the world once the sun went down. You really want to go into town, Lubbock? What I want is to be in Disneyland eating a snow cone, but I think we ought to go up there and take a look. If things are normal, if they feel normal, okay, we'll try reporting it there. But if we see anything that looks the slightest bit wrong, we head for Ely on the double. She looked up at him solemnly. I'm going to hold you to that. You can. He put the truck in gear and began to roll slowly toward the road. To the west, the gold glow which had been filtering through the sand was down to an ember. Overhead, more stars were poking through, but they were beginning to shimmy as the flying sand thickened. Steve, you don't happen to have a gun, do you? He shook his head, thought about going back into the Quonset to look for one, and then put the idea out of his head. He wasn't going back in there, that was all. He just wasn't. No gun, but I've got a really big Swiss Army knife, one with all the bells and whistles. It's even got a magnifying glass. That makes me feel a lot better. He thought of asking her about the statue, or if she'd had any funny ideas, experimental ideas, and then didn't. Like the thought of going back into the Quonset building again, it was just too creepy. He turned onto the road, one arm still about her shoulders, and started toward town. The sand blew thickly across the wedge of light thrown by his high beams, twisting into lank shadows that persistently reminded him of hanged men dangling from hooks. 5. The body of his sister was gone from the foot of the stairs, and that was something. David stood looking out through the double doors for a moment. Daylight was fading, and although the sky overhead was still clear, a darkening indigo, the light was dying down here at ground level in a choke of dust. Across the street, an overhead sign reading Desperation Coffee Shop and Video Stop swung back and forth in the wind. Sitting beneath it and looking attentively across at him were two more coyotes. Sitting between them, tatty feathers flapping in the wind like the feathers on some old woman's church and bingo hat, was a large, bald-looking bird David recognized as a buzzard, sitting right between the coyotes. That's impossible, he whispered, and maybe it was, but he was seeing it just the same. He dressed quickly, looking at the door to his left as he did. Printed on the frosted glass pane were the words, Desperation Town Office, along with the hours, 9 to 4. He tied his sneakers and then opened the door, ready to turn and run if he sensed anything dangerous. If he sensed anything moving, really. But where would I run? Where is there to run? The room beyond the door was gloomy and silent. He groped to his left, expecting something or someone to reach out of the darkness and grab his hand, but nothing did. He found a switch plate, then the switch itself. He flipped it, blinked as his eyes adjusted to the old-fashioned hanging globes, then stepped forward. Straight ahead was a long counter with several barred windows like teller stations in an old-fashioned bank. One was marked Tax Clerk, another Hunting Permits, another Mines and Assay. The last one, smaller, bore a sign reading MSHA and Federal Land Use Regs. Spray-painted on the wall behind the clerk's area in big red letters was this: In these silences, something may rise. I guess something did, too, David thought, turning his head to check the other side of the room. Something not very... He never finished the thought. His eyes widened, and his hands went to his mouth to stifle a shriek. For a moment the world went gray, and he believed he might faint. To stop it happening, he took his hands away from his mouth and squeezed them against his temples instead, renewing the pain there. Then he let them drop to his sides, looking with wide eyes and a hurt, quivering mouth at what was on the wall to the right of the door. There were coat hooks. A Stetson with a snakeskin band hung on the one nearest the windows. Two women hung on the next two, one shot, the other gutted. This second woman had long red hair and a mouth that was open in a silent, frozen scream. To her left was a man in khaki, his head down, his holster empty. Pearson, maybe, the other deputy. Next to him was a man in jeans and a blood-spattered work shirt. Last in line was Pye. She had been hung up by the back of her motocop shirt. Cassie Stiles was on it, standing in front of her dream floater van, with her arms folded and a big grin on her face. Cassie had always been Pye's favorite motocop. Pye's head lolled over her broken neck, and her sneakers dangled limply down. Her hands. He kept looking at her hands. Small and pink, the fingers slightly open. I can't touch her. I can't go near her. But he could. He had to, unless he planned to leave her there with Entragian's other victims. And after all, what else was a big brother for, especially one who wasn't quite big enough to stop the boogeyman from doing such an unspeakable thing in the first place? Chest hitching, greenish-white curds of soap drying to scales on his skin, he put his hands together again and raised them in front of his face. He closed his eyes. His voice, when it came out, was trembling so badly he hardly recognized it as his own. God, I know that my sister is with you, and that this is just what she left behind. Please help me do what I have to do for her. He opened his eyes again and looked at her. I love you, Pye. I'm sorry for all the times I yelled at you or pulled your braids too hard. That last was too much. He knelt on the floor and put his hands on top of his bowed head and held them there, gasping and trying not to pass out. His tears cut trails in the green goo on his face. What hurt most was the knowledge that the door which had swung shut between them would never be opened, at least not in this world. He would never see Pye go out on a date or shoot a basket from downtown 2 seconds before the buzzer. She would never again ask him to spot her while she stood on her head or want to know if the light in the refrigerator stayed on even when the door was closed. He understood now why people in the Bible rent their clothes. When he had control of himself, he dragged one of the chairs which stood against the wall over to where she was. He looked at her hands, her pink palms, and his mind wavered again. He forced it steady. Just finding he could do that, if he had to, was a welcome surprise. That wavering toward grief returned more insistently as he stood on the chair and observed the waxy, unnatural pallor of her face and the purplish cast of her lips. Cautiously, he let some of the grief in. He sensed it would be better for him if he did. This was his first dead person, but it was also Pi, and he did not want to feel scared of her or grossed out by her. So it was better to feel sorry, and he did. He did. "Hurry, David." He wasn't sure if that was his voice or the other's, but this time it didn't matter. The voice was right. Pi was dead, but his father and the others upstairs weren't. And then there was his mother. That was the worst thing. In a way, even worse than what had happened to Pi, because he didn't know. The crazy cop had taken his mother somewhere, and he might be doing anything to her. Anything. "I won't think about that. I won't let myself." He thought instead of all the hours Pi had spent in front of the TV with Melissa Sweetheart in her lap, watching Crazy Tunes. Professor Crazy had yielded his place of honor in her heart to the motocops, especially Cassie Stiles and the handsome Colonel Henry, over the last year or so, but the old prof still seemed like the right answer to David. He only remembered one of Professor Crazy's little songs, and he sang it now as he slipped his arms around the dead girl and lifted her free of the hook. "This old man, he played one..." Her head fell against his shoulder. It was amazingly heavy. How had she ever held it up all day long, as little as she was? "He played knick-knack on my thumb." He turned, stepped clumsily down from the chair, staggered but did not fall, and took Pi over to the windows. He smoothed her shirt down in the back as he went. It had torn, but only a little. He laid her down, one hand under her neck to keep from bumping her head on the floor. It was the way Mom had showed him when Pi had been just a baby and he had asked to hold her. Had he sung to her then? He couldn't remember. He supposed he might have. "With a knick-knack, paddywhack, give a dog a bone." Ugly dark green drapes hung at the sides of the windows, which were narrow 9-foot floor-to-ceiling jobs. David tugged one down. "Crazy prof goes rolling home." He laid the drape out beside his sister's body, singing the stupid little song over again. He wished he could give her Melissa's sweetheart to keep her company, but Lissa was back by the wayfarer. He lifted Pi onto the drape and folded the bottom half over her. It came all the way up to her neck, and she looked better to him now, a lot, as if she were at home, sleeping in bed. "With a knick-knack, paddywhack, give a dog a bone," he sang again. "Crazy prof went rolling home." He kissed her forehead. "I love you, Pi," he said, and he drew the top of the drape over her. He remained beside her for a moment with his hands clasped tightly between his thighs, trying to get control of his emotions again. When he felt steadier, he got to his feet. The wind was howling, daylight almost gone, and the sound of the dust against the window panes was like the light tapping of many fingers. He could hear a harsh, monotonous squeaking sound, reek, 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 as something turned in the wind, and he jumped when something else out there in the growing darkness fell over with a bang. He turned from the window and went hesitantly around the counter. There were no more bodies, but papers had been spilled behind the window marked tax clerk, and there were spots of dried blood on some of them. The tax clerk's high-backed, long-legged chair had been knocked over. Behind the counter area was an open safe. David saw more stacks of paper, but no money and nothing that looked disturbed. To the right was a small cluster of desks. To the left were two closed doors, both with gold lettering on them. The one marked Fire Chief didn't interest him, but the other one, the office of the town safety officer, did. Jim Reed, that was his name. Town safety officer, what you'd call chief of police in a bigger burg, David murmured, and went over to the door. It was unlocked. He felt along the wall again, located the light switch, and flicked it. The first thing he saw when the lights came on was the huge caribou's head on the wall to the left of the desk. The second was the man behind the desk. He was tilted back in his office chair. Except for the ballpoint pen sticking out of his eyes and the desk plaque protruding from his mouth, he might have been sleeping there. That's how relaxed his posture was. His hands had been laced together across his ample belly. He was wearing a khaki shirt and an across-the-chest belt like Antragian's. Outside, something else fell over, and coyotes howled in unison like a doo-wop group from hell. David jumped, then glanced over his shoulder to make sure Antragian wasn't sneaking up on him. He wasn't. David looked back at the town safety officer. He knew what he had to do, and he thought if he could touch Pi, he could probably touch this stranger. First, however, he picked up the phone. He expected it to be dead, and it was. He hit the cutoff buttons a time or two anyway, saying, "Hello? Hello? Room service, send me up a room," he thought, and shivered as he put the handset back in the cradle. He went around the desk and stood next to the cop with the pins in his eyes. The dead man's name plaque, James Reed, town safety officer, was still on his desk, so the one in his mouth was something else. "Ops here," was printed on the part sticking out between his teeth. David could smell something familiar, not aftershave or cologne. He looked at the dead man's folded hands, saw the deep cracks in the skin, and understood. It was hand lotion he smelled, either the same stuff his mother used or something similar. Jim Reed must have finished rubbing some into his hands not long before he was killed. David tried to look into Reed's lap and couldn't. The man was too fat and pulled in too close to his desk for David to be able to see what he needed to see. There was a small black hole in the center of the chair back. That he could see just fine. Reed had been shot. The thing with the pens had been done, David hoped, after he was already dead. "Get going. Hurry." He started to pull the chair back, then shouted with surprise and jumped out of the way when it overbalanced almost at his touch and spilled Jim Reed's dead weight onto the floor. The corpse uttered a great dead belch when it hit. The plaque in its mouth flew out like a missile leaving its silo. It landed upside down, but David could read it with no trouble just the same. "The buck stops here." Heart pounding harder than ever, he dropped to one knee beside the body. Reed's uniform pants were unbuttoned and unzipped, exposing some decidedly non-reg underdrawers. Vast, silk, peach-colored. But David barely noticed these. He was looking for something else, and he sighed with relief when he saw it. On one well-padded hip was Reed's service revolver. On the other was a keychain clipped to a belt loop. Biting his lower lip, somehow sure that the dead cop was going to reach out, "Oh, shit, the mummy's after us," and grab him, David struggled to free the keys from the belt loop. At first, the clip wouldn't open for him, but he was finally able to get it loose. He picked through the keys quickly, praying to find what he needed, and did. A square one that almost didn't look like a key at all. A black magnetic strip ran down its length, the key to the holding cells upstairs. He hoped. David put the key ring in his pocket, glanced curiously at Reed's open pants again, then unsnapped the strap over the cop's gun. He pulled it out, holding it in both hands, feeling its extraordinary weight and sense of inhaled violence. A revolver, not an automatic with the bullets buried away in the handle. David turned the muzzle toward himself, careful to keep his fingers outside the trigger guard so he could look at the cylinder. There were bullet heads in every hole he could see, so that was probably all right. The first chamber might be empty. In the movies, cops sometimes did that to keep from shooting themselves by accident. But he reckoned that wouldn't matter if he pulled the trigger at least twice, and fast. He turned the gun around again and inspected it from the butt forward, looking for a safety catch. He didn't see one and very gingerly pulled back on the trigger a little. When he saw the hammer start to rise out of its hood, he let off the pressure in a hurry. He didn't want to fire the gun down here. He didn't know how smart coyotes were, but he guessed that if they were smart about anything, it would probably be about guns. He went back out into the main office. The wind howled, throwing sand against the window. The panes were bruised purple now. Soon they'd be black. He looked over at the ugly green curtain and the shape which lay beneath it. "Love you, Pie," he thought, and then went back out into the hall. He stood there a moment, taking deep breaths, eyes closed, gun held at his side with the muzzle pointed at the floor. "God, I never shot a gun in my life," he said. "Please help me to be able to shoot this one. Jesus' sake, amen." That taken care of, David started up the stairs. Chapter 3 1 Mary Jackson was sitting on her bunk, looking down at her folded hands and thinking arsenic thoughts about her sister-in-law. Deirdre Finney, with her pretty pale face and sweet stone smile and pre-Raphaelite curls. Deirdre, who didn't eat meat. It's like cruel, you know? But smoked the smoke. Oh, yes. Deirdre had been going steady with that rascal Panama Red for years now. Deirdre with her Mr. Smiley Smile stickers. Deirdre, who had gotten her brother killed and her sister-in-law slammed into a Hicksville jail cell that was really death row, and all because she was too fucking fried to remember that she'd left her extra pot under the spare tire. "That's not fair," a more rational part of her mind replied. "It was the license plate, not the pot. That's why Antragian stopped you. In a way, it was like the angel of death seeing a doorway without the right mark on it. If the dope hadn't been there, he would have found something else. Once you caught his eye, you were cooked, that's all, and you know it." But she didn't want to know it. Thinking of it that way, as some sort of weird natural disaster, was just too awful. It was better to blame it on Peter's idiot sister, to imagine punishing Deirdre in a number of non-lethal but painful ways. Caning, the sort they administered to thieves in Hong Kong, was the most satisfying, but she also saw herself hiking the tip of a pointed high-heeled shoe into Deirdre's flat little fashion plate ass. Anything to get that room-for-rent look out of her eyes, long enough for Mary to scream, "You got your brother killed, you stupid twat! Are you reading me?" into Deirdre's face, and to see the understanding there. "Violence breeds violence," she told her hands in a calm, teacherly tone. Talking to herself under these circumstances seemed perfectly normal. "I know it. Everybody knows it. But thinking about it is so pleasant sometimes." "What?" Ralph Carver asked. He sounded dazed. In fact, gruesome idea, he sounded quite a bit like the walking short circuit that was her sister-in-law. "Nothing. Never mind." She got up. Two steps took her to the front of the cell. She wrapped her hands around the bars and looked out. The coyote was sitting on the floor with the remains of Johnny Merrinville's leather jacket in front of its forepaws, looking up at the writer as if mesmerized. "Do you think he got away?" Ralph asked her. "Do you think my boy got away, ma'am?" "It's not ma'am, it's Mary, and I don't know. I want to believe it, I can tell you that. I think there's a pretty good chance that he did, actually. As long as he didn't run into the cop," she added to herself. "Yeah, I guess so. I had no idea he was so serious about the praying stuff," Ralph said. He sounded almost apologetic, which Mary found weird under the circumstances. "I thought it was probably, I don't know, a passing fad. Sure didn't look that way, did it?" "No," Mary agreed. "It didn't." "Why do you keep staring at me, Bosco?" Merrinville asked the coyote. "You got my fucking jacket. What else do you want? As if I didn't have a pretty good idea."
He looked up at Mary. You know, if one of us could get out of here, I think that mange basket might actually turn tail and...
Hush, Billingsley said. Someone coming up the stairs.
The coyote heard it, too. It broke eye contact with Marinville and turned around, growling. The footfalls neared, reached the landing, stopped. Mary snatched a glance at Ralph Carver, but couldn't look for long. The combination of hope and terror on his face was too awful. She had lost her husband, and that hurt worse than she had ever imagined anything could. What would it be like to see your whole family snatched away in the course of an afternoon? The wind rose, howling along the eaves. The coyote looked nervously over its shoulder at the sound, then took three slow steps toward the door, ragged ears twitching.
Son, Ralph called desperately. Son, if that's you, don't come in. That thing's standing right in front of the door.
How close? It was him, the boy. It really was. Amazing. And the self-possession in his voice was even more amazing. Mary thought that perhaps she should reevaluate the power of prayer. Ralph looked bewildered, as if he didn't understand the question. The writer did, though. Probably 5 feet and looking right at it. Be careful.
I've got a gun, the boy said. I think you better all get under your bunks. Mary, get as far over to my dad's side as you can. Are you sure he's right in front of the door, Mr. Marinville?
Yes, big as life and twice as ugly as my friend Bosco. Have you ever fired a gun before, David?
No.
Oh, Moses. Marinville rolled his eyes.
David, no,
Ralph called. Belated alarm was filling his face. He seemed to be just realizing what was happening here.
Run and get help. Open the door and that bastard'll be on you in two jumps.
No, the kid said. I thought about it, Dad, and I'd rather chance the coyote than the cop. Plus, I have a key. I think it'll work. It looks just the same as the one the cop used.
I'm convinced, Marinville said, as if that settled it. Everybody get down. Count to five, David. Then do it.
You'll get him killed, Ralph yelled furiously at Marinville. You'll get my boy killed just to save your own ass.
Mary said, I understand your concern, Mr. Carver, but I think if we don't get out of here, we're all dead.
Count to five, David, Marinville repeated.
He got down on his knees, then slid under his bunk. Mary looked across at the door, realized that her cell would be directly in the kid's line of fire, and understood why David had told her to get way over on his father's side. He might only be 11, but he was thinking better than she was.
One, the boy on the other side of the door said.
She could hear how scared he was, and she didn't blame him. Not a bit.
Two.
Son, Billingsley called. Listen to me, son. Get on your knees. Hold the gun in both hands and be ready to shoot up. Up, son. It won't come on the floor. It'll jump for you. Do you understand?
Yeah, the kid said. Yeah, okay. You under your bunk, Dad?
Ralph wasn't. He was still standing at the bars of his cell. There was a scared, set look on the swollen face hovering between the white-painted bars.
Don't do it, David. I forbid you to do it.
Get down, you asshole, Marinville said.
He was staring out from under his bunk at David's father with furious eyes. Mary approved of the sentiment, but thought that Marinville's technique sucked. She would have expected better from a writer. Some other writer, anyway. She had this one placed. The guy who'd written Delight, perhaps the century's dirtiest book, was cooling his heels in the cell next to hers, surreal but true, and although his nose looked as if it might never recover from what the cop had done to it, Marinville still had the attitude of a guy who expects to get whatever he wants, probably on a silver tray.
Is my dad out of the way?
The kid sounded unsure as well as scared now, and Mary hated his father for what he was doing, plucking the boy's already overstrained nerves as if they were guitar strings.
No, Ralph bawled, and I'm not going to get out of the way. Get out of here. Find a phone. Call the state cops.
I tried the one on Mr. Reed's desk, David called back. It's dead.
Then try another one. God damn it, keep trying until you find one that...
Quit being dumb and get under your bunk, Mary said to him in a low voice. What do you want him to remember about today? That he saw his sister killed and shot his father by mistake all before supper time? Help! Your son's trying. You try, too.
He looked at her, his cheek shiny pale, a vivid contrast to the blood clotted on the left side of his face.
He's all I got left, he said in a low voice. Do you understand that?
Of course I do. Now get under your bunk, Mr. Carver.
Ralph stepped back from the bars of his cell, hesitated, then dropped to his knees and slid under his bunk. Mary glanced over at the cell David had wriggled out of, God, that had taken guts, and saw that the old veterinarian was under his bunk. His eyes, the only young part of him, gleamed out of the shadows like luminous blue gems.
David, Marinville called, we're clear.
The voice that returned was tinged with doubt.
My dad, too?
I'm under the bunk, Ralph called.
Son, you be careful. If...
His voice trembled, then firmed.
If it gets on you, hold onto the gun and try to shoot up into its belly.
He poked his head out from under the bunk, suddenly alarmed.
Is the gun even loaded? Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. He paused.
Is it still in front of the door?
Yes, Mary called. The coyote had taken a step closer, in fact. Its head was down, its growl as steady as the idle of an outboard motor. Every time the boy spoke from his side of the door, its ears twitched attentively.
Okay, I'm on my knees, the boy said.
Mary could hear the nerves in his voice more clearly now. She had an idea he might be approaching the outer edges of his control.
I'm going to start counting again. Make sure you're as far back as you can be when I get to five. I don't want to hurt anyone by accident.
Remember to shoot uphill, the vet said. Not a lot, but a little. Okay?
Because it'll jump.
Right. I'll remember.
One, two...
Outside, the wind dropped briefly. In the quiet, Mary could hear two things with great clarity. The rumbling growl of the coyote and her own heartbeat in her ears. Her life was in the hands of an 11-year-old with a gun. If David shot and missed, or froze up and didn't shoot at all, the coyote would likely kill him. And then, when the psycho cop came back, they would all die.
Three?
The quiver which had crept into the boy's voice made him sound eerily like his father.
Four?
Five. The doorknob turned. Two. For Johnny Marinville, it was like being tumbled back into Vietnam again, where mortal things happened at a zany speed that always surprised you. He hadn't held out much hope for the kid, thought he was apt to spray bullets wildly everywhere but into Bosco's hide, but the kid was all they had. Like Mary, he had decided that if they weren't out of here when the cop came back, they were through. And the kid surprised him. To begin with, he didn't throw the door open so it would hit the wall and then bounce back, obscuring his line of fire. He seemed to toss it open. He was on his knees and dressed again, but his cheeks were still green with Irish spring soap, and his eyes were very wide. The door was still swinging open when he clamped his right hand over his left on the butt of the gun, which looked to Johnny like a 45, a big gun for a kid. He held it at chest level, the barrel tilted upward at a slight angle. His face was solemn, even studious. The coyote, perhaps not expecting the door to open in spite of the voice which had been coming from behind it, took half a step backward, then tensed on its haunches and sprang at the boy with a snarl. It was, Johnny thought, the little backward flinch that sealed its doom. It gave the boy all the time he needed to settle himself. He fired twice, allowing the gun to kick and then return to its original aiming point before pulling the trigger a second time. The reports were deafening in the enclosed space. Then the coyote, which had gone airborne after the first shot and before the second, hit David and knocked him backward. His father screamed and scrambled out from under his bunk. The kid appeared to be fighting with the animal on the landing beyond the doorway, but Johnny found it almost impossible to believe the coyote could have much fight left in it. He had heard the slugs go home, and both the hardwood floor and the desk were painted with the animal's blood. "David! David! Shoot it in the guts!" his father screamed, dancing up and down in his anxiety. Instead of shooting, the kid fought free of the coyote as if it were a coat he had somehow gotten tangled in. He scooted away on his butt, looking bewildered. The front of his shirt was matted with blood and fur. He got the wall against his back and used it to push his way onto his feet. He looked at the gun as he did it, seemingly amazed to see it was still there at the end of his arm. "I'm okay, Dad. Settle down. I got it. It never even nipped me." He ran his hand over his chest and then down the arm holding the gun, as if confirming this to himself as well. Then he looked at the coyote. It was still alive, panting harshly and rapidly, with its head hung down over the first stair riser. Where its chest had been, there was now a wide, bloody dent. David dropped to one knee beside it and put the barrel of the .45 against the dangling head. He then turned his own head away. Johnny saw the kid's eyes clenched shut, and his heart went out to the boy. He had never enjoyed his own kids much. They had a tiresome way of upsetting you for the first 20 years and trying to upstage you for the second 20. But one like this wouldn't be so bad to have around, maybe. He had some game, as the basketball players said. "I'd even get down on my knees with him at bedtime," Johnny thought. "Shit, anybody would. Look at the results." Still wearing that stressful expression, the look of a child who knows he must eat his liver before he can go out and play, David pulled the trigger a third time. The report was just as loud, but not quite as sharp somehow. The coyote's body jumped. A fan of red droplets as fine as lace appeared below the stairwell's railing. That harsh panting sound quit. The kid opened his eyes and looked down at what he had done. "Thank you, God," he said in a small, dull voice. "It was awful, though. Really awful." "You did a good job, boy," Billingsley said. David got up and walked slowly into the holding area. He looked at his father. Ralph held his arms out. David went over to him, starting to cry again, and let his father hold him in a clumsy embrace that had bars running through the middle of it. "I was afraid for you, Guy," Ralph said. "That's why I told you to go away. You know that, don't you?"
"Yes, Daddy."
David was crying harder now, and Johnny realized even before the kid went on that these tears weren't about the flea bag. No, not these.
"Pie was on a hook downstairs. Other people, too. I took her down. I couldn't take the other ones down. They were grown-ups. But I took Pie down. I sang to
He tried to say more, but the words were swallowed in hysterical, exhausted sobs. He pressed his face between the bars while his father stroked his back and told him to hush, just hush. He was sure David had done everything for Kirsten that he could, that he had done fine. Johnny let them have a full minute of this by his watch. The kid deserved that much just for opening the goddamn door when he knew there was a wild dog on the other side waiting for him to do it, and then spoke the kid's name. David didn't look around, so he said it a second time, louder. The boy did look around then. His eyes were red-rimmed and streaming. "Listen, kiddo, I know you've been through a lot," Johnny said, "and if we get out of this thing alive, I'll be the first one to write you a commendation for the Silver Star. But right now we have to get gone,
and Trajan could be on his way back. If he was close by, he probably heard the gunshots. If you've got a key, now's the time to try it out.
David pulled a thick ring of keys out of his pocket and found the one which looked like the one Trajan had used. He put it in the lock of his father's cell. Nothing happened. Mary cried out in frustration and slammed the heel of her hand against the bars of her own cell.
"Other way," Johnny said. "Turn it around."
David turned the key over and slid it into the lock slot again. This time there was a loud click, almost a thud, and the cell door popped open.
"Yes!" Mary cried. "Oh, yes!"
Ralph stepped out and swept his son into his arms, this time with no bars between them. And when David kissed the puffy place on the left side of his father's face, Ralph Carver cried out in pain and laughed at the same time. Johnny thought it one of the most extraordinary sounds he had ever heard in his life, and one you could never convey in a book. The quality of it, like the expression on Ralph Carver's face as he looked into his son's face, would always be just out of reach. 3. Ralph took the mag key from his son and used it to unlock the other cells. They stepped out and stood in a little cluster in front of the guard's desk. Mary from New York, Ralph and David from Ohio, Johnny from Connecticut, old Tom Billingsley from Nevada. They looked at each other with the eyes of train wreck survivors.
"Let's get out of here," Johnny said. The boy had given the gun to his father, he saw. "Can you shoot that, Mr. Carver? Can you see to shoot that?"
"Yes to both," Ralph said. "Come on." He led them through the door, holding David's hand as he went. Mary walked behind them, then Billingsley. Johnny brought up the rear. As he stepped over the coyote, he saw that the final shot had pretty much pulverized the animal's head. He wondered if the kid's father could have done that. He wondered if he could have done it. At the foot of the stairs, David told them to hold on. The glass doors were black now. Night had come. The wind screamed beyond them like something that was lost and pissed off about it.
"You won't want to believe this, but it's true," the boy said, and then told them what he had seen on the other side of the street.
"Behold, the buzzard shall lie down with the coyote," Johnny said, peering out through the glass. "That's in the Bible, Jamaicans, chapter 3.
"I don't think that's funny," Ralph said.
"Actually, neither do I," Johnny said. "It's too much like something the cop would say."
He could see the shapes of the buildings over there and the occasional tumbleweed bouncing past, but that was all. And did it matter? Would it matter even if there were a pack of werewolves standing outside the local pool hall, smoking crack and watching for escapees? They couldn't stay here in any case. And Trajan would be back. Guys like him always came back.
"There are no guys like him," his mind whispered. "There were never in the history of the world any guys like him, and you know it." Well, maybe he did, but it didn't change the principle of the thing a bit. They had to get out.
"I believe you," Mary told David. She looked at Johnny. "Come on, let's go into the police chief's office, or whatever they call it here."
"For?"
"Lights and guns. Do you want to come, Mr. Billingsley?"
Billingsley shook his head.
"David, may I have the keys?"
He handed them to her. Mary slipped them into the pocket of her jeans.
"Keep your eyes open," she said.
David nodded.
Mary reached out, took Johnny's hand. Her fingers were cold as ice, and pulled him through the door which led into the clerk's area. He saw what was spray-painted on the wall and pointed to it. "In these silences, something may rise. What do you suppose that means?"
"Don't know, don't care. I just want to get to some place where there are lights and people and phones and we can't..."
She was turning to the right as she spoke, her eyes touching on the fold of green drape below the tall windows with no particular interest. The shape beneath it was too slight for her to recognize. Then she saw the bodies hung on the wall. She gasped and doubled over, as if someone had struck her in the belly, then turned to flee. Johnny caught her, but for a moment he was sure she was going to get away from him. There was a lot of strength hidden in that slim body.
No, he said, shaking her in what was partly exasperation. He was ashamed of that, but couldn't entirely suppress it. No, you have to help me. Just don't look at them.
But one of them's Peter.
And he's dead. I'm sorry, but he is. We're not. Yet, anyhow. Don't look at him. Come on.
He led her swiftly toward the door marked Town Safety Officer, trying to think how they should proceed. And here was another disgusting little facet of this experience. He was becoming aroused by Mary Jackson. She was quivering in the circle of his arm. He could feel the softness of her breast just above his hand, and he wanted her. Her husband was hung up like a fucking overcoat right behind them, but he was still getting a fairly respectable stiffy, especially for a man with possible prostate woes. Terry was right all along, he thought. I am an asshole.
Come on, he said, squeezing her in what he hoped was a brotherly way. If that kid could do what he did, then you can hang in there. I know you can. Get it together, Mary.
She pulled in a deep breath.
I'm trying.
Oh, shit. We've got another mess here. I'd tell you not to look, but I think we're a little beyond the niceties.
Mary looked at the sprawled body of the town safety officer and made a thick noise in her throat.
The boy. David. Jesus Christ. How did he do it?
I don't know, Johnny said. He's some kid, all right. I think he must have knocked Sheriff Jim there out of his chair trying to get his keys. Can you go next door to the fire chief's office? It'll be quicker if we toss both of them at once.
Yes.
Be prepared. If Fireman Bob was at home when Entragian went nuclear, he's probably just as dead as the rest of them.
I'll be okay. Take these.
She handed him the keys, then went to the door marked Fire Chief. Johnny saw her start to glance toward her husband, then look away again. He nodded and tried to send her some mental encouragement. Good girl. Good idea. She turned the knob of the fire chief's door, then pushed it open with tented fingers, as if it might be booby-trapped. She looked in, let out a breath, and gave Johnny a thumbs up. Three things, Mary. Lights, guns, any car keys you spot. Okay?
Okay.
He went into the cop's office, running quickly through the keys on the ring David had gotten as he did. There was a set of GM car keys, which Johnny guessed probably belonged to the cruiser Entragian had brought him back in. If it was out there in the parking lot, it would help them, but Johnny didn't think it was. He had heard an engine start up shortly after the madman had taken Carver's wife away. The desk drawers were locked, but the right key in the lock of the wide drawer above the knee-hole opened all of them. He found a flashlight in one, and a locked box marked Ruger in another. He tried several different little keys on the box. None worked.
Take it anyway?
Maybe, if neither of them found other guns somewhere else. He crossed the room, pausing to look out a window. Flying dust was all he could see. Probably all there was to see. God, why hadn't he taken the interstate? That struck him funny. He giggled under his breath as he looked at the closed door behind Reed's desk. Sound like a crazy man, he thought. Never mind Travels with Harley. If you get out of this alive, you should think about calling the book Travels with Looney. That made him laugh even harder. He put one hand over his mouth to stifle it and opened the door. The laughter stopped in a hurry. Sitting amid the boots and shoes, partly obscured by hanging coats and spare uniforms, was a dead woman. She was propped against the closet's side wall and dressed in clothes Johnny thought of as boot-scootin' secretarial. Tapered slacks, not denim, and a silk shirt with entwined roses embroidered over the left breast. The woman appeared to be staring at him with round-eyed wonder, but that was only an illusion. Because you expect to see eyes, he thought, and not just big red sockets where they used to be. He restrained an urge to slam the closet shut and pushed the hanging garments to either side along the pole instead, so he could see the rear wall. A good idea. There was a gun rack with half a dozen rifles and a shotgun in it back there. One of the grooves was empty, third from the right, and Johnny guessed that was where another shotgun, the one Entragian had pointed at him, usually went. Hot day.